My question to you, Tim, is do you want to bring this one in just for a switch, or do you want me to do the usual thing?
I will bring it in. Let's switch it up.
Right.
We're throwing caution to the wind here. Let's go.
Yeah.
There's music, and then what do you usually say? Welcome, everybody, to the 15 Years Later podcast, right?
That's the one.
All right. I'm cannonballing into this, bitch. Here we go.
We should keep this.
Welcome, everybody, to the 15 Years Later podcast. My name is Tim Larson. I'm here with, as always, Mike Wilden. How you doing, Mike?
What's going on? I'm doing pretty well. It's a nice day. How are you, Tim?
I'm doing great. I'm a little sleepy because I was up writing notes for this until 3 a.m. And as we have discussed and agreed, that's pretty much your fault. We also have a guest here today. Why don't you go ahead and introduce your friend that we have as a guest today?
Yeah, I am very excited to have with us Mr. Matt Drufke. Drufke, how are we doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
Great. It's great to see you, man.
Oh, it's good to see you.
Drufke and I were on the Chicago suburban comedy scene together. He still produces shows today. Obviously, I've been out of it for a while. But I thought he would be a perfect guest for today's topic.
So we're here to discuss blog episode 14, and the title of that is How to Succeed at Failing Your Dream, written by Mike Wilden. It has a lot to do with, Mike, with your history in stand-up comedy right after high school, and you and Drufke were in the arena together back in the day there, and so we brought in Drufke to give some perspective on that, and I'm looking forward to this. I can tell you guys, we've only been on this meeting for about 2 minutes, and listening to you guys interact, it's obvious that you guys really like and respect each other, so I'm going to do everything through sarcasm to punch holes in that as best I can.
Oh, perfect. Okay, good. Yeah.
Yep.
It's got too nice, too quick.
Let's go for it.
That's right. So I'll just get your reactions to this before we actually get into our part two and talk about the blog. Last weekend, I had some friends out, and a couple of years ago, we went to an axe throwing place and paid some money to have somebody coach us to throw an axe at a target. I'm sure you guys have heard of this activity, maybe even done it. The place lets you bring your own beer. They didn't have a license to sell beer, but they didn't care if you brought your own beer. So we drank alcohol and threw axes.
Seems totally safe.
A place. I've seen the videos where the axe comes back at your face and we were ready to dodge. You know, we liked it so much that I built my own target in the backyard and I bought some axes off of the Amazons and just got loaded in the backyard and threw axes right after 4th of July. What says America more than that?
True. Yes, yep. I guess that is correct. Yeah, there's nothing more patriotic than losing a finger, like potentially losing a finger all the time.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
In one way or another.
Yep.
Yes.
I was wearing open-toed sandals the whole time. I will admit to that as well. And
smart.
Dropped an axe one time, got pretty close to one of the little piggies. but it's still going wee all the way home.
How often in axe throw, like, what do you think your percentage is of actually getting the blade of the axe to stick in the board? Because to me, that would be the hardest part. Like, the blade is only so thin, and then you have the whole rest of the axe that could hit the board. Like, how is there a technique to guarantee?
This is going to sound stupid, but there is some skill to it. Like, I was glad that we went somewhere.
How does that sound? No. There should absolutely be skill of axe chucking at a target.
I mean, you're drinking with your friends in the backyard. Does it really matter if it sticks in the target or not? I mean, it's really just, it's more around being together and around alcohol and something that you could kill yourself with. But yeah, you're looking for, like, with a bigger axe, one rotation and it comes back around and it hits. There's a certain distance you is preferred to throw from. And I would say I'm probably around 50%. And, my wife, a little less than 50%, but she's real excited when it hits the bullseye. Like, it's a big moment. There's some jumping up and down and stuff.
It is nice that we found a way to make darts way more dangerous.
Hell,
like, that's,
yeah.
That's a big win.
If I could light the thing on fire when I throw it, I would. I'm just going
to. I was about to say, that's what you got to do next 4th of July. Strap some fireworks on those axes.
Yep.
And really go nuts.
This isn't new for me. A few years ago at a friend's house, we had a spare tire that didn't have a rim on it, you know, just the rubber part of the tire. Mm-hmm. We put some burnable gel igniter stuff in there and lit that on fire and rolled it down the driveway to each other. So, I mean, It's a hobby. I like to do things that are real stupid that you could get yourself hurt with. But that's just me.
That's fantastic.
Drufke, you might not know this. I don't know if Wilderness told you this, but today is an important day to us. We have both signed up on a writer's challenge that happens tonight. Have you
Yes.
heard of this?
I'm not, no.
All right, Wilden, I've been talking for a while. Why don't you explain the writer's challenge?
Well, so I just stumbled on this like through an Instagram ad or something, but it's just a writing contest where it's a short story. It's fantasy writing or something like that, 500 words or less. And you pay an entry fee, and like part of your fee goes to, you could choose from a few different charities or whatever. And they email you the prompt for what you have to write about, like right before. You have 48 hours. You have 2 days to actually like write the thing. And I don't know, it just sounded like a lot of fun to me, especially as we've been writing so much more. So yeah, I signed up for it and I told you about it. And then about a week later, you're like, "Hey, I don't want to step on your toes." I was like, "No, the more the merrier. This is great." So we're both doing this 500 word writing contest, and there's a chance I've already reached 500 words in explaining this, which I know is a joke I made last week, but it's still relevant, I think. So it's going to be a challenge for us.
Yeah, that sounds super awesome, though.
It'll be fun.
It was cool in concept, and then tonight's the actual night. So this is happening live at it's midnight in the East Coast. And so 11 p.m. we get the prompt, and we got 48 hours to write stuff. But yeah, he's right. Both of us are, we'll just go on and on and on. So 500 words is quite the limit for the two of us.
Oh yeah, I cannot. Yeah, I absolutely understand. Yeah, I know. I have a little blog as well, and sometimes I'll be like, "Oh, I'm gonna write a few hundred words about Fast and Furious 9," and then I'm like, "Oh, I've written 4,000 words about Fast and Furious 9." A
There
movie
you
that I
go.
can best describe as being perfectly okay. Like,
Drufke, real quick, I do want to I go ahead and plug your site, because this is kind of how I got started, is you let me write something on your site,
yeah, you had
and
that great
that kind
piece
of just lit the fire
about
for me.
baseball stadiums. Yeah,
Oh, that was
I write
you.
for
Okay.
I write for a site we're called FancyBoysClub.com. It's myself, a couple other comedians, Brandon Andreessen and Jack Baker. We write about politics and pop culture and sports and music and whatever kind of comes across the gate. We get special guest writers. Jordan Holmes from the Knowledge Fight podcast is a regular contributor. All kinds of fun people just talking real kind of silly stuff. So it's always a good time. FancyBoysClub.com is where you find us.
Great.
It's fantastic. I Drufke, I love reading anything you write.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I check it out anytime I see a link to something. I'm like, oh yeah, that interests me, regardless of who wrote it. I like to check it out. You mentioned Jordan Holmes. I don't think Jordan Holmes probably cared for me all that much back in the day, but like I admire him a lot, especially with his writing and his stand. Like there are things in his stand-up back like a decade ago, and things that he's written since then that still stick with me today. And one thing I was gonna that during the pandemic, I think this just goes to show how little we all had to do during that couple of years, right when COVID hit, and then 2021. He wrote like an 8-piece article where he reviewed every Taylor Swift album, just
Yes.
almost out of spite. And I was never a Taylor Swift fan. I had no interest in any of this information, but I was like, I don't know. Let's see what he has to say about it. It'll be kind of funny. I ended up reading the entire thing, all 8 pieces or however many pieces it was. I read the whole thing.
Oh, it is now ongoing. Every time there's a new record, like 3 days later, just something pops up in my inbox. The Jordan, it was called the Swiftening. And yeah,
Of course.
He figured he had never deliberately listened to a Taylor Swift song at all, so he chose to listen to all of them, like one album per week. Yeah, no, those are fantastic. Jordan is so wonderful. He liked you. Jordan had a hard time liking reality. So like, I would not hold anything that was
Fair.
too,
I like this guy.
I would not take anything personally with that gentleman who I call, who I consider a very close friend who I love very much. So no, Jordan, Jordan loved everyone. And he still does.
Well,
Tim, you would like him a lot. He was very funny.
I
He
have to
is
say,
very
like,
funny.
I'm putting some stuff together here. And Drufke, I don't know if you know this, but the reason we're here, Mike and I met 15 years later after you graduated. We went to Buffalo Wild Wings. We started trading stories back and forth. And one of the main themes of that conversation had to do with baseball. And it was about going to all the stadiums. And Mike brought up the fact that he wrote an entry on your blog. Now, I didn't know that was you when you got here today. And because he brought that up, another beer later is when we came up with the idea of let's write a blog about this whole thing. So we could probably actually say thank you for inspiring this idea. Or people who are listening today who are tired of it can blame you for inspiring this idea.
Here's how I look at it. For the people who love it, I happily accept 100% of the credit. For people who dislike it, you guys just screwed up my great idea. So I don't know what happened there.
That's what we're best
at. I respect
that.
You could
listen to the story about us trying to get a bottle of wine open one day. That was a mess. All right, guys. If you're ready, let's move on to part two and get into this blog and tear it apart.
Let's do it.
All right. Hey, let's talk about the blog. Normally we bring each other's in, but this one was written by me. I called it How to Succeed at Failing Your Dreams, and it was all about my time in the world of suburban stand-up comedy, which, of course, is the main reason we have Mr. Drufke here, also just because he's a delightful human being, but mainly for the comedy. So, let's get this thing started. First of all, Drufke, what did you think, real quick? Because I sent you this a little before we actually published the blog.
Yeah, and I read it. Thoughts? And I really liked it. And then I read it again like an hour ago, just right before this recording. And like, you've done a really nice job. Like, you did a really nice job setting the tone of like what things feel like, as well as just like how many other elements fall into someone starting comedy that you wouldn't expect, like camaraderie with other comedians, sometimes camaraderie with other comedians you don't want to have camaraderie with, as well as like that overwhelming fear and panic and adrenaline, and just like how wonderful moments can happen in small places, and disappointments can happen in very large places. Like it was a writing that made me, you know, it like every good piece of writing makes you reflect on what your experiences were and the moments you had and things like that. So I really enjoyed reading it. Both times that I read it.
Cool.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that a lot.
So, Mike, let me ask you a question. I'm just going to start with the title. How to Succeed at Failing Your Dream. I think it's great because it gets you engaged from the beginning. That makes you want to read it. Like, what the hell is that supposed to mean? So, as a long story short, as much as you possibly can, because that's not your nature, give us a description of how you succeeded at failing.
That is a challenge for me, which we're going to have to work on here pretty soon, starting at about 11 p.m.
I like that you had to pause before trying to go long story short. It's kind of funny to me.
Well, yeah, it's like you said, it's not my nature. Yeah, roughly a decade ago, you know, within a few year span, I attempted to begin a career in stand-up comedy. Now, at the time, I thought I wanted to be like the next great stand-up comedian and, you know, have all those specials and, you know, become famous for it. That is no longer how I feel about it. I love it, but it's just, it's different for me now. But along that process, I met a lot of great people. You know, that's Drufke we have here today. We mentioned Jack Baker earlier. I'm a big fan of his as well. I experienced a lot of things that were just very unique, and they're, you know, fun stories to tell. And I think I learned, there were a lot of skills I think I gained from trying and improving at comedy, that even though I didn't get where I wanted to in comedy, did help me in other parts of life. And I didn't really see that until later. And then, you know, it's kind of similar to the travel thing, right? I've talked about the trip out to Portland, which I mentioned in this blog, but, you know, the Phoenix, Portland, Seattle thing, because I booked that whole thing on my own, traveled on my own, et cetera. And I'm still seeing benefits from it today. And that's kind of how it was for comedy. So I was kind of like, you know, I think if I had gotten what I wanted back then, I don't know if I would be as happy with where I'm at as I am today.
Okay.
I still have that yearning to go on stage and to perform. And I'd love to get to like a certain point where like I could have, you know, an hour of material or whatever to put on a show, but I don't want to be famous for it. It's just, that's too much pressure. There's too much that goes into it. And I have all the respect in the world for people that, you know, that continue to just go through that grind. And also like, it doesn't have to be, you know, that doesn't have to be the one definition of success. You know, it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. It's your thing. Obviously I think age kind of plays a part in realizing that, but anyway, so when you and I were talking back and forth that first day, just about stories from life, and you asked me, hey, so what's going on with the stand-up comedy thing? I know you were into that. And I kind of told you a little bit of everything I just told you now, and a couple of stories. And, you know, those stories obviously were a big foundation for us doing this thing.
Right.
But when it came time to write about that part of our conversation and just that part of the story, it was just kind of what came to mind. Like, I didn't really achieve my dream of being, you know, the next great stand-up comedian. But is that a bad thing? And so that's just kind of how it happened, I guess.
Yeah. If that's your long story short version, you have no shot at this 500 word thing.
You are correct.
That's also like a really, and I understand that like most people start comedy with that idea of like fame and things like that. I think it's crazy just to understand like how, like there are lots of people who make a living professionally doing comedy that you'll never know, like people who are just either like road warriors or people doing corporate work, people who are punch-up writers, things like that. Like, you know, look, I think you don't not go into comedy wanting a little bit of fame and notoriety and like wanting to see your name and have people know who you are, but just that, like, you know, to understand that like what you can gain from comedy, not just in like the skill set you learn and things of that nature, but also just in like the friendships you gain, as well as like just like general life lessons that you learn, can be so invaluable that I think like the farther you go into it, the more you realize that like, look, the fame thing happens to 1 in 20 million people who try. And that, but that in no way does that mean that the other 19 million are failures. It just means that they're gaining things in other regard.
Yeah, I like that spin on it. That's great.
Well, and that's kind of the point. It's like, hey, I think I have succeeded in where I need to go in life, but supposedly failed the dream. So how is that a success? That's kind of the whole idea.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, Drefke, that's exactly it.
So my next question is for Drefke. You said you've read this twice.
Yes.
Okay. Now we're just being honest here. I want to get to this before we get any further. Are you Fred? Did you lose your shit over a glass of chocolate milk?
No, I remember. I remember Mike getting chocolate milk. Like, I remember that being a thing, that those early Comedy Shrine days. But that was never something that would have bothered me. I mean, though, for the record, now I would feel very bad if it actually was me and it just happened while I was drunk, because then I could also see drunk me getting furious about someone ordering chocolate milk. So I don't. Now I'm worried. This is why I'm on the episode.
Yep. It's a big reveal.
I'm very afraid this has quickly become a Zoom intervention in a hurry. And I don't like if this is where, if this is where the rest of the episode's going, it will get hostile. Perhaps that's what we want.
I'm all for it.
Hey, Mike, get those the clicks however you can, baby. I understand.
Well, so about that. No, it's not you.
I figured it wasn't, but I thought, you know, we got to be on the record here. If we're not being genuine, we're not doing anything right. So, hey, let's go back in time. And Drefke, give us a little bit of a visual of Mike Wilden being on stage. What do you remember about Mike up on stage as a stand-up comedian?
It's weird when I remember that. I'm trying to remember, Mike, you would have been like 2011, 2012, somewhere in that vein when you were getting started?
Yeah, I graduated college in 2011, and I think I started in like on open mics right around that time. Yeah.
Yeah. Like in the in the time when the Shrine was not in the mall but outside the mall, right? That would have been right
Right,
then.
right, right, right.
Yeah, I mean, I just remember like a very thin dude, the very, you know, very like very personable, like had a very ease of stage presence on stage, which
Okay.
sometimes is very uncommon with newer people. Like generally a new comedian will tend to get like very nervous and speak very quickly, and whose voice has a higher register, you know, things like that. Things that I entirely embody even to this day right now.
Yeah.
Mike was, he would always kind of like let things roll to him, which I always remembered like being something that was different among the like 30 comics you would see in a night. Like, but you know, also like, again, like something that I always liked is he's just likable on stage. So many people go on stage and because they have heroes who are angry or aggressive or depressed or morose, or like they will embody that on stage. And that's fine. There are people who do that very well, but it also makes them seem like they're a real bummer to be around. Like Mike on stage, never see it. Watching Mike on stage, you were never like, gosh, I never want to. I would want to avoid a conversation with this person. Like he always gave off such a charm and likability, which I think is something that always helps you on stage. If the audience is like, no, this seems like a decent person, they're going to want to give you extra respect and attention as you move on.
That's great. I'm really enjoying getting a
Indeed.
little
Thank
view
you.
into like the industry and the culture of stand-up comedians and how you guys sort of relate to each other. This is really fun for me. By the way, I'm
Hey.
glad that you're like that on stage because off stage, zero charm, zero likability. Honestly,
He's a
yep,
fucking
thanks.
monster.
Yeah. Yes.
Should probably give you a minute to react to that, Mike, if you'd like.
I mean, I'm very thank you. That's very, very nice. Yeah, but I mean, I was very nervous several of those times, but you know, I guess you can't show it. It's funny you say that too, because one of my comedy heroes, especially at that point in time, was Lewis Black. I
Yeah.
absolutely loved Lewis
Me
Black, but
too.
I think I just understood I'm not Lewis Black. Like, I'm not the same person. So it's kind of hard for me to be, you know, it's one thing to have a guy that's very similar to him. It's like, oh yeah, he could pull it off. I can't pull that off. And I think I just knew that. I can get angry at times, and I think I had some fun, angry things that were probably inspired by him, but yeah, it's if I went up there and I was yelling fuck every other word, it just wasn't, you know, nobody was
Yeah,
gonna buy that.
I never remember seeing you on stage and being like, oh, Mike's angry tonight. You know what I mean? Like,
I would like
and
to see that.
that is to
There is.
your credit and benefit, you know? Like I never remember, or like I never remember you like going full off, like going double barrel on an audience member or something like that. As you know, is another typical thing of like newer inexperienced comics of just like, oh, this isn't going well. I must blame the crowd.
Sure. Well,
there is a reason for that, and that's because I'm actually not that good at improv. I'm not great at thinking on my feet. So if somebody would interrupt me, I'd be like, okay, I got to think of something to say now, and I'm
Yeah.
already out of time for it to be effective. And then I would think about it roughly an hour and 45 minutes later, like, oh, I should have said that. That happened a
I
lot.
should have said,
But
shut up.
yeah, that was just because, yeah. But I there was one time where I had just experienced a breakup from a long relationship, and it was an open mic, and I went and I just vented on stage, and I think it was very raw and very real, and it worked really well because the audience was just kind of with me, and that was the one time I just kind of went off the cuff, and it was still funny, but people really felt because I was really, really feeling that. I remember I tried it again a couple months later, the same idea, only I forced it. I was like, oh, this is gonna work well. So I tried to reproduce it, and it did not go well at all. And I just had an emotional breakdown on stage and kind of left. And I remember I went outside just to kind of get a breath of fresh air. And we were mentioning earlier, Jordan Holmes is out there smoking a cigarette. And he was like, even Jordan was like, hey, you okay?
Wellness check after a stand-up routine.
Yeah. So
That's
there
good.
was one time I went a little insane, but yeah, I thank you for that. But I think, you know, it's less because I was patient with the audience or
It is so
and
hard.
more just because.
It is so challenging when catharsis works well on stage. And then you're like, oh, I just need to find catharsis every time
I
I'm on
found the
stage. And
goal,
it's
right?
like,
I found the
no,
goal.
it's
Let me go
not.
back
Yeah.
to it.
That's
Yeah.
not how it works. Like, that's not the. It
Right.
would be like, tip for like, for a musician, if you were like, oh, if the audience liked when I broke my guitar on stage one time, I just have to smash a guitar every time I'm on stage. And it's like,
Yep.
no, then you're just an asshole. Like,
Yep.
then no one likes you. Like, then you're just the guy giving everyone splinters. Like, that's no fun.
Well, I do have the microphone for the band, right? I'm the lead singer, and so in between songs, there's plenty of opportunity for me to say something stupid, and I have learned how to say stupid things to the crowd. Like I know exactly what you guys are talking about in that room. And also, our most popular YouTube video is me falling on my ass. Like that's been played more than anything else. I get where you guys are going with that. So let's get into some of the actual stuff in the blog here.
Actually,
Oh, go ahead.
can I ask
Actually, I want to talk more about you falling on your ass.
Well, yeah, I'd love to talk more about that. Drefke, do you for your do you have any like bit that you've kind of retired just because the world has gone a different way?
Ooh.
Because I know back when I was on stage, I had like one of the bits I was kind of known for in the group, or just, you know, in that scene was one that I don't think would work today. It was the Power Rangers
Sure.
being racist one. Did I ever tell you this?
Yeah.
But did I tell you why I stopped telling it?
No.
So I was at a mic at the Shrine, and I'd brought a friend from work. Who is kind of a he was a good old country boy, and there's nothing wrong with that. But he came and he brought his girlfriend, and it was a rough night for the crowd anyway. But he was up front and he was laughing and everything. He was a great audience member, and so I told that joke. And after the show, he came up and I just was like, "Hey, thank you so much for coming. Thanks for laughing. You were great." And he said, "Oh man, I loved it. I love that you were the only one that had the balls to be racist." And I was like, "I'm sorry, what? I don't think you got the point of the joke. That's the bad thing that I'm making fun of." He's like, "Yeah, but," and he kind of repeated it. And I went, "You know, if that's the message people are getting, maybe I shouldn't be telling this one anymore."
Yeah, it's so hard when you go in with an idea and you're like, I'm gonna have this take on things, and you find people who don't not only don't see that, but then take a joke in the worst possible way. To answer your question, like, there have been times when I've stopped telling a joke because it's been about like a topic that is long since passed or things like that. And then also, like, for me, like, personally, like, when I started stand up, my son would have been 2, who's my oldest son now. And so, like, obviously, as he's gotten older, I don't want to tell, like, I don't want to tell jokes about when he was a little kid. I
Right.
want to talk about who he is now and talk about my youngest son and things like that. Like, yeah. And like, as life changes happen, you're either like, you're putting jokes to rest that don't apply to your life anymore, or you're rewriting them to apply to who you are in a more modern version of that. So yeah, I understand exactly what that is. But yeah, that is, I have also had situations like that where I'm like, oh, this is a joke about this, and someone's like, hey, I really loved when you said it. It's like, no, like, you've missed every other
Yeah.
part of that.
Yeah. Okay, let me get into the blog here and ask some questions. Mike, right as you start in this, you get into the breakup real quick at your in your blog. And then you talk about the legend, your father giving you advice about attitude, and the rest of the blog is reflecting on the experience. So I have two questions in this, and feel free to jump in there, Matt. First one, and how much did your parents support you when you started doing this and as it kept going on? I mean, I know your mother's initial reaction, but as you were going through it, and then Drefke, if you want to run in there and talk about your support system as you got started too, I'd love to hear it.
I'll throw this in there just in case. I can't remember if we've told this story on the podcast or not, but when I first told my mom that I wanted to do stand up and that I was ready to go to an open mic, And I was like, seriously telling, like, this is what I want to do. And she kind of was like, eh. And then her question was, well, do you even have any like material? Like, yes, mom, come on. Give me a little credit here. But no, I mean, my parents always supported me in anything I did. It was kind of funny though, because my mom basically refused to come and see me do stand up live because, and I always thought it was kind of silly, but then she was having that conversation with me, and my sister was there too. And my mom said, well, I would hate to see you do poorly or see the audience heckle you, because then I'd be the defensive mother and get up and start, fighting people or whatever. And like,
I would
and my
love to see
sister
that.
immediately, well, right. Yeah. And my sister jumped in and said, yeah, same here. I would just, it terrifies me. And they told me that. I'm like, I get it, but also that only makes me want you to be at a show even more. Like you
Sure.
said, that would be great. I don't know. I mean, this is kind of a maybe a silly statement, but my parents know me well, and I feel like they maybe knew what this was going to be for me, which is the lesson I learned that I, write in this whole thing. But I don't know. I don't think it's that they didn't think I had it in me. I think they just know me. It was similar to like, so in 8th grade, I had just discovered cross country and I did really well at it. In my town league basketball team the year before, the guy was the high school head track coach, and he just told me, go out for cross country. I was like, what's cross country? He just said, you'll be good at it. And I remember him grinning and everything. I'm like, okay, whatever. Turns out he was right. Well, then I saw like all the popular kids are playing football. And then I saw some of the other people playing football. And I was like, well, if they could do it, I could do it. I had that middle schooler ego. And I brought it up to my parents one time. I said, guys, I think I'm going to try out for football. And they both went, no. And I was like, all right, I guess that's the end of that. So that this wasn't the same, but I think it was just, I don't know. I think part of it was just, it was very, my mom was just concerned for me.
Yeah, nervous, right? They were
Yeah, but she
supporting
was
from a
always supportive.
distance.
She like they my parents never told me not to do it. They never tried to discourage me from it. They were always encouraging. Anytime they'd see an article in like the paper about like there's this open mic showing up here, there's a club that's opening up here, they'd cut it out, they'd show me. Like they were always on board.
That's
But
well, I mean,
yeah.
it takes a bit of bravery to get up there and get started, right? Like, I have a whole band behind me when I'm on stage, but it's you're there with a microphone by yourself to sink or swim, right? Drufke,
No, that's.
what about your support system?
I mean, yeah, that first time up is so hard. You're absolutely right. I like my wife, ex-wife now, but my wife at the time was very supportive. Like always looking for ways to encourage me and get me up and things like that. I think she knew, and like even now, like the job that I have is. Like it doesn't fulfill me. It's a nice check. It pays bills and makes sure everyone is fed, like that, like between like that people are fed and taken care of, and we do the stuff. And so doing comedy, it was the creative endeavor for me. It was the thing that allowed me to have like an outlet, a creative force, something I was passionate about, something that eventually I got pretty good at. And so like in that regard, it always went well. My parents came to shows every now and then. My mom still does every now. We lost my dad a couple years ago, but he had come to shows in the past as well. It was always super weird when they're there because, like, my comedy is often of drinking
That joke out.
and
I gotta throw that joke out. Mom's in the
yeah.
room.
And
I gotcha.
but I never tried to do that. I wanted them to see what it looked like. Like I wanted them to see what my material was about. And so I would try and give them a relatively accurate representation of what the act was. I think it's different for them as like, as I imagine that you view your child one way. And then, when you're performing stand up, you're giving the audience like a very interesting observation of how you view yourself. And I think maybe sometimes for parents to look at their child that way and be like, oh gosh, I never looked at him that way. Like, I think that that is you know, there are some revelatory elements to that, even though, you know, comedy is all about, you know, like a farcical nature and blowing things up like out of proportion and using, you know, metaphor in a creative way and all those things. But, you know, whenever you say, when you say something on stage, the audience is not like their initial reaction isn't, oh, this person is saying something. This person is being like overly they're like overly bragging for comedy. They're thinking like, no, this is what this person is saying. This must be something like some element of who they are as a person. So it is like it was that was the weirdest regard is having them out and seeing the side of me that they had never seen before. So and you know, stand up allowed me very early to be self-deprecating. It allowed me very early to rehash past trauma, to do a lot of those things. And so for I think for them to see that that was the big surprise for them, and it made them uncomfortable. But I think as we would then have conversation, that they came to really appreciate that I had that outlet.
I think honestly, Drufke, I think you have the best sense of self-deprecating humor that I've ever seen. I like to think that I have a really good self-deprecating sense of humor, but I absolutely love yours. When we were doing the roast of Jack Baker for his like bachelor party thing, I remember when his soon-to-be bride at that point in time, obviously now his wife, went up to read a couple, and she wrote a couple of jokes that were both like just about you. And like just scorching like jokes about you. And then she just put the paper down. She went, "So I haven't really gotten to talk to Drufke about this, but I can tell you he wrote both of those jokes." And that was the funniest part of the night for me. I
Yeah,
thought that
that's
was the
correct.
funniest thing.
I, Colleen, at some point, we had had a conversation, and I had said like, it is because I will say like when people threw me a roast, also like right before I got married, and my wife came to that, and at first said like I didn't. She said she didn't understand like I don't understand how you can believe that being mean and like spending time to work hard to be mean to someone is an act of kindness or love. But then when she saw us together enjoying what we were doing and how much we appreciated it, like you're not loving the fact that the joke is maybe hitting a little too close to home. What you're loving is that like someone worked really hard and has like spent this time getting to know you, that they're able to combine like their care for you and their craft of the joke and put it together into this beautiful thing. Like roasting is so much fun. It's why one of the things I really dislike in comedy, which has kind of become a recent trend, is like ideas of roast battles where it's just like two people who have never met each other before. Cause then you're just being like mean about what they look like physically. And I've never enjoyed that. But I do love like nothing is better than like those old Dean Martin roasts when it's like, oh, those 12 guys have been drunk together for 30 years. And it's just the most fun thing to watch.
You say that about a roast battle, and I immediately go to like the rap battles from back in the day. Like that's all that was. Just grab a microphone and make fun of the guy that you're looking at, right?
But now, like now, imagine if those people had known each other forever. So your raps are like personal and deep. I would love that. That would be something I would find amazing.
The main difference is they
Well,
have to rhyme. The rap
but
battle thing. It's kind of the rule is you have to rhyme.
the other endearing part of that is, you know, when somebody puts that time and love and effort into making that joke and they want to make you laugh. That's also them expressing that, hey, like we see you have flaws and we love you anyway because we see you as this delightful person that we love and respect. And you can not even just look past flaws, but you can accept people for who they are as a whole, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Well, like, look, I see these things in you, but I love you in spite of and for them.
I mean, who's perfect, right? Who's
Yeah,
perfect? Just put it out on
right.
display and
Absolutely.
enjoy it, right? Okay, Mike. So my second question about the breakup coming up so quickly in this blog, bringing this back. One of the only things I remember, or remembered, I should say, when you graduated, when we met that first day, was that you were interested in stand-up comedy. So I came out with that right away. Hey, so how'd things work out with stand-up comedy? How awkward was it when I asked that question? You're like, oh, I didn't fucking come here to talk about that.
I didn't mind talking about it. I just it was kind of I had the same reaction as I would have to a breakup, which is kind of how I've been comparing it for years anyway, which is
Right.
like, oh yeah, we're not doing that anymore. That ended a while ago.
Yeah.
Just immediately
Yeah.
made me think of like, oh, it's as if I was like dating a girl and you went, oh, how's this girl? Well, about that.
Yeah, there you go.
So yeah.
Yeah, you definitely did not make up the phrase "we broke up" to write this blog episode. I remember specifically you saying that term that day. You'd had that one in your pocket for a while. Okay, so after that intro, this blog, there are three sections that you talk about: the garage show, stumbling along the Oregon Trail, and then a glass of chocolate milk. Let's hit the garage show first. I would like some more details about you walking into the neighbor's house. You just mentioned that you walked in the wrong house, but I'd love to hear a little more of your memory of how embarrassing it was and what they said, and was there a shotgun involved?
Now, I mean, it's only worth a mention because it didn't take very long. I just kind of went in and I was like, hey, wait a second. And then there were people I didn't recognize and went, this isn't his house, is it? And they went, no, it's next door. Oh, okay, thanks. Like they were nice about it. But it was just, I'm glad they were nice about it because it was, you never know when you walk into a strange person's house uninvited.
That's right.
Yeah, that's called a felony, by the way. That's called a
Hard
Hard felony.
to
How shows are the craziest thing. I had to do like I remember there was one time I got paid. It was me and a couple comedians, and we got paid to do a 40th or 50th birthday party, and we're in like River Park. We're in like the area where like every place is a mansion that was owned by like a guy who committed tax fraud or an athlete. Like the houses were just insane. And I just remember like performing and just being like, no one here is going to be able to relate to how I'm feeling. They had us perform this like in front of this enormous fireplace. All of us just have like sweat pouring down our back. I legitimately thought I was going to be hunted for sport after that show. It was crazy. Like it's funny because people often talk about like that the worst place to perform comedy is in bars, and it's true. Bars are terrible places, but like the people who say that haven't performed in nearly as many house shows as some of us have, because those are just crazy. It just reminds you how like there is a place for like you need the right atmosphere for things. That's why
Yeah.
it's why comedians don't like often telling people they're comedians, because no one wants to hear like, ah, tell me a joke. And it's like, that's not this is
Right.
not what that format is. Like, that's not what we're supposed to be doing right now.
Right. That's the musician's version of that is play Freebird. I totally get what you're saying, though. People who go to a comedy club are paying for the experience of sit down, shut up, and laugh at the comedians. Whereas if they're at a party with their friends, that's not why they're there. And that's a difficult crowd to get engagement from, right? Is that kind of what you're getting
Well,
at?
I mean, it's also,
Yeah,
but also, yeah, sorry. Also, like, it's sometimes like when you have certain stand-up jokes are formatted to tell to a crowd, like Drufke was saying, that's not what this is for. It's not going to have the same punch when you're just saying it one on one or to a couple of people, because this is like I'm saying this to a crowd, and it's not funny when it's out of context.
It also really sucks when like if you're at a party, if you're at a bar where there's like not a back room, like these people are there to spend time with their friends. Like they're there to go out and have a social experience. And now you're saying, no, we need you all to be quiet and focused. And the only
Right.
noise we would like to hear from you is laughter. And like there, Mike, I'm sure you did at so many shows where like you're in the side corner of a restaurant or a bar, and now you're just ruining someone's evening. Like you have surprised someone with a present they don't want. Like, and even being told that it's there, don't care for it. Like
Yeah.
it's the worst thing. I can't possibly imagine what that would feel like. Like right now, like even as a comedian who's gone through it, like if I'm having dinner with my family and I see them like start to set up a microphone on the side, I'm just like, we have to go. Like, go before this gets started, or we're just gonna be very rude people.
So this great. This is a good transition to my next question because we're talking about when the crowd is not there for what you're there to perform. Mike, you talk about this being one of your favorite shows, being in this garage. So give us a description of that show or Drefke, some of your best shows. Like, what does it feel like to have when the crowd is there for you and you have the engagement and you get to do what you wanted to do? Like, how good of a feeling is that?
I've heard people describe it as a high, and I think that's probably the, I mean, it's there's almost nothing better than that. It's just the rush of endorphins and the adrenaline when you get that laughter you're looking for. And when a crowd is good and engaged, it's so much fun. You know, for everything I talk about like the difficult parts of the road along stand-up comedy, when it goes well, it's great.
Yeah.
It's so good.
When you perform in front of a large enough crowd, the laughter is physically palpable. Like you feel it on your chest. And that feeling is unlike anything I have felt. It's like feeling like you are this random puzzle piece and that you have finally found the puzzle that you belong into. Like it just to have that feeling of like, oh, everything fits, everything understands, all this work that I've done has paid off
That's
is
great.
so rewarding and stimulating, and is the only substitute you have for like when things don't work. Not there's nothing worse as a comedian, like to make it kind of very simple for listeners and Tim for you, is that like as you are writing jokes, you understand that at some point you are including pauses because you need a spot for the audience to laugh. Like you have your setup,
Sure.
which leading up, you have your punchline, that's your laugh line, pause for laugh. So when you give the audience that pause to laugh and nothing happens, that is the worst feeling, you know? And it's
Yes.
something that like never, like I've seen like experienced road comedians try new things and still have an audience be like, no, that one doesn't work for us. Like, we don't care for it. And it's, you know, because laughter is just something that's like inside of you. You can't force it out of you. So like to know that like that night, the formula that you have spent these years on and you're like, I know how to make this work, to watch it fail in front of you, it is now you're feeling like that puzzle piece. And you're not even in the same, like, you're not even in the picture that you're supposed to be a part of. You're just like off to some random side. Like, as so, like, that is just as devastating as great as killing feels. Like, it's such a weird scenario of emotions.
It like when you get the laughter, it makes you want to be on that stage forever. Like, man, I could just do this all night. This is the most fun thing. This is the best feeling. When you get just the silence, you want to run away as fast as you can. You're like, I need to get off this stage now. Like, and that's why, like, it's so tough to go on stage, not get a reaction, and then be like, well, I've got, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, however long left, and keep going. When you have that feeling initially, because you got to work yourself back from that pretty quickly. But yeah, I can second that. That is tough.
I remember one day there was a period where I was getting ready. This was 12 years ago now. I'm getting ready to record my record, and I've just taken a series of shows so I can like run the whole thing. I can get it prepared. I can get it ready. And I'd just been, with no false modesty, I'd just been kind of crushing everywhere I went. I was killing hours. I was doing half hour, 45 minute. Every place I go was always going super well. And it was like 4 days before I was supposed to record. I'm doing a half hour in a country club. It's a room I'd done well in before, and I've always been good in it. And I was just like, great, I've done this half hour. I know it's going to go well. And from minute one, the audience was dead silence. And like, here's the thing is like, I've been in rooms before where the audience is talking and they don't care that there's comedy. They're just going to have their own conversations. And that's just what it is. Sometimes you just can't blend. Sometimes you're just like, all right, well, whatever. There was nothing I could have done. What dead silence is an audience being like, no, we heard you. And we are summarily, as a group, choosing to reject you.
Here's your feedback.
And that was just like a full body blow. And I think it's why you'll see, Mike, you talked about like the need to flee. Almost worse are the comedians who are like, no, I have to stay up till I get some sort of reaction, and just digging themselves in a deeper and deeper and deeper hole that they can't get out of.
And maybe trying a little harder, like Mike was talking about, trying to recreate a cathartic moment, and it's just not there. You're trying to put a square peg in a round hole, or however that phrase goes.
Yeah, absolutely. Or you start getting hostile, or you start getting sad, like any of those outward emotions that are getting in the way of like what you consider your performance clicks are
Yeah.
just are yeah, it's terrible.
So I have two reactions to you guys talking about this. One is I remember Johnny Carson doing monologues on the Tonight Show, and he was great when jokes bombed because he was funnier when it didn't work. You know, like he had a real good reaction when it didn't work, and you know, why not? He's getting paid anyway.
Those late night guys love bomb jokes. Like when you're listening, I don't know if either of you have ever listened to Strike Force 5, the thing with like the five late night hosts got together during the writer's strike. They talk about that a lot, where they love when a joke bombs, and it just makes them happy. And it's just this weird thing, but yeah, I don't know.
Well, you get
Well,
to get
seems
off
like a late
script,
night thing,
right?
especially. Yeah, I
And
guess so,
the
yeah.
other thing is like. Like so the monologue jokes were written in a room between 20 guys, all of whom are
Right.
just trying to like make things better, add a word, take out a word, do whatever you need to do to make it the best possible joke. But that reaction from the joke bombing, that's all Carson. That's pure
Right.
Carson. That's just a guy, you know? And like that, I th like that's why that's so great, is because like you're seeing just a pure emotion come out of a guy.
Yeah, he was so good. Like the hands would go right in the pockets, or he'd check the mic. Is this mic on? Like, did you guys turn this thing? He was just so good at that. The other thing is trying to relate to you guys. I can just think about being a musician on stage, right? And if I finish a song and there's a lot of laughter, something really bad happened. So I'm going for a different reaction. But we've had shows where I know exactly what you guys are talking about. When the crowd is dialed in and we finish a song and there's this loud applause and cheering, it's such a great feeling. But I've also finished songs and heard what people are having for dinner tomorrow night. Like it's and instead of 5 minutes, if it's a 4 hour show and we're two songs in and I already realize the crowd's not going to be here, it's like, oh shit, is this going to be a long day? And then again, I've got four other guys with me on stage. So we just kind of look at each other and shrug and go, well, let's play some good music and enjoy it for ourselves. You know, if the crowd's not going to do it, we're here anyway. Let's just enjoy it for ourselves. But that'd be a lot harder to do standing there by myself.
Yeah,
One
and
of
it's
my.
no, please.
You go ahead, please.
I was gonna say, and also like at least there's a yeah, like the camaraderie is the thing, but also like you guys can at least appreciate like, well, at least we're playing the songs well. Like the five of us are together, we're working as a unit. That just like this crowd is not reacting in some way. When you're a comedian and a joke doesn't go well, not only are you up there alone, but you're like, oh, you're telling me that this thing that I've worked on for ye like years doesn't it doesn't matter. Like it doesn't work. And so that is what's so soul crushing.
Sure.
Yes. Drefke, one of my favorite bits from you, one of the older ones, was you opening for an Eagles cover band. I absolutely love that story. That was what I was thinking about this entire part of this conversation. I just the like I for what was the one thing that the like it was like one person made a noise or something
Oh
and
my
you're
God.
like,
Yeah,
there it
I'll
is.
do it like so. I'm opening up in this place that seats over 600 people, this theater in Crystal Lake. The audience does not know there's comedy, so which means, like, again, they don't know there's going to be a comedian. They are here for very good renditions of their favorite band. And now they're told, hey, you have to wait 20 minutes for that because here comes this guy and he's going to try and tell jokes. And so, first, like, you're not getting laughs at first because you're just trying to cut through confusion. Like all these people, like, what is it? Who is it? How long is he on stage? And you know, like you're just hearing people look at their watches, like, which is the like there's such a bad feeling. So I always the joke, and I talk about this, is like, you know, you learn as a comedian that you want to get off on a laugh, which means if you tell a joke and you get a big laugh and you don't think you're getting another laugh that good the rest of the night, if you've got a couple minutes to kill, you bury it and you say, hey, that's great. This is where I want to be. Good night. So I'm supposed to do 20 minutes. It's 18 minutes of just tanking so hard. And like me getting hostile and depressed and upset. And I do one joke and I do the joke, set it up, do the punchline. And I just hear one person like 12 rows back just go, ha! And that was all I needed. I was like, good night. Thank you. I'm off. I ran off stage.
And uproarious laughter.
Yeah. Just ate a party sub that was meant for a band. I just ate it as a guy.
Oh, that's great. Okay, so let's the second part of you talking about comedy here in this blog, Mike, is
pretty relevant.
We get to what's that?
Pretty relevant what you're about to say.
Yeah, we get to stumbling along the Oregon Trail. So we've gone from one of your favorite shows to struggling, right? So here's what I thought we would do. From your guys' perspective, and I think we've done this a little bit, but help people who are listening who haven't experienced this, maybe haven't gone to a lot of shows, describe for us a typical open mic if you were traveling. Like you go in someplace you don't know, it's an open mic, you're just trying to get on stage and do some jokes. What's the environment like?
I mean, so let's clarify first what it is. We're like, as a stand-up comedy open mic gives you the right to stand on a stage and say whatever you want for 3 to 5 minutes, provided that the only skill you need is the ability to write your name down on a piece of paper. That's all you have to do. And somehow that makes you a qualified comic.
Yeah.
Which already presents its own challenges, because since there is no set metric, you're now going on stage with people who've never been on stage before, with people who don't understand. It is crazy. Because part of doing stand-up is making your performance seem natural and authentic and always seeming like no matter how many times you've said it the first time, it leads to a lot of people being like, oh, I can do that. You know, much like as I imagine if there are people who like go to karaoke every now and then be like, I could front a band. You know what I mean? And so like, It just leads to people who think like, oh, I just need to go up on stage and do a silly voice or tell a story about how like my mom is fat and fell, you know, like just like do all these things. You're like, now there's a skill and a craft to writing and to working things out. So like sometimes at an open mic is so unpredictable because you could go up on with material that I know works well, is gonna do well, gets an audience engaged.
Yeah.
And if an audience has just had to watch like five people be not funny, like not just tell jokes that don't work, not tell jokes at all. And now you're trying to follow that up. The audience is not on board to like get back on board very quickly. Like it's what makes open mic so hard is that you never know what's coming up before you. So you're always trying to like bob and weave along with it. Like
sure.
Mike, I don't know what else you have to add with that.
I mean, that's the best. You said it better than I ever could. That's exactly it. The other thing I think I mentioned in the blog is a lot of these open mics you go to, most of your audience is going to be other comedians. And while several, you know, if people have been there before and if people have the right attitude about it, they know, hey, like it's a show, we're going to enjoy it. But, you know, there are going to be some egos in that room and they're going to want to be the funniest person in the room. And so they'll actively not put themselves in the mindset to enjoy your material or anybody's material until they get on stage because they think, hey, I want to be the funniest one here. And they might get a little judgy. You know, maybe they're judging like, oh, that was pretty good. Oh, I could do better than that. I know at a young age, early on, I probably found myself doing that. Like, I could probably do better than that guy. Or, oh, no, I don't know if I, like, you know, you just, it's a thing that happens. But if you get enough really big egos in there, then it's just like, you know, you're not really telling jokes to an audience. You're telling jokes to your competition in their mind.
I want to kind of share a story back to something that you're super right. Like, and it's not just comedians. Like I have been at shows where male audience members have been upset because their girlfriend's been like, "Hey, that's a funny person on stage." And the guy's like, "No, I'm the
Yes.
funny person on stage." And it gets so ridiculous. I want to tell a story that goes back to kind of the point I was making. And it's funny, I don't remember why this story came up, but it's just something, it's a old story I've been sharing. This was a story that happened years, probably almost 20 years ago now, at the Zanies Comedy Club in Nashville. I was not present to this, but I've heard enough people tell it that I know this is what happened. Guy shows up to the open mic down there, and he has a styrofoam cooler, like one of those things you'd buy at a gas station. And he comes on stage with the cooler, and he pulls out a dead possum. And he is
Okay.
like just holding up the possum. He's talking to the possum. He's like having the possum talk to the audience. And the audience is just horrified, as they should be. It's a dead possum. And at some point, when not getting the reaction he wants, he takes the possum tail and begins spinning the thing above his head, like hair and like rotting skin and things like that flying off into the crowd. Like this man is like physically picked up and removed from the club. And so like that's a horrendous story. There's even a funnier part of that story where like this comedian is not allowed back in the club, obviously, but is furious that he can't get his cooler back. And so like that's the funny part of the story from a comedy angle. But
Sure.
now like from an open mic angle, imagine you're the next comic. Like imagine you're the guy after that. And you have seen, like, the audience has just seen that. And now it's you. And you had, like, this material that you wanted to work on. And even scarier, like, you're at a club. So, like, you're trying to impress the owner and you're trying to do that. And all the audience is doing is, like, terrified they have dead animal hair on them.
You have to address it, right? Like, you can't just have that happen and start your normal joke about your girlfriend. Like, you have to address that somehow and transition, right?
I mean, what the club did that night, which was very smart, is they're like, look, we're taking a 10-minute cigarette break. Like, we're just
Okay.
gonna have to and so, which is what you have to do. But like at the show I run, we normally have very great audiences, but every now and then there's a real drunk person that we have to toss out, or there's someone heckling, or the and as the host of that show, as the person who's going up in between every comedian, you have to know they're like, all right, look, this thing happened. We can't just immediately bring someone else up. We have to set them up for success. So, like, you just do a couple jokes, you make a couple announcements, you do whatever you can to get the audience like back in the mindset of like, okay, we are now ready to watch a thing. Like, and that is that's so challenging. It's why the host is the hardest role in comedy, because no one ever should leave a comedy show being like, I really could do with more host. But and so because of that, it's nothing that people strive for. But if a show doesn't have a good host, it's a train wreck.
Sure. I can see that.
I got to host a couple of open mics, not too often, but I mean I learned a lot of that actually from you and from Jack. I was in the light and sound booth at the Comedy Shrine in Aurora they were talking about earlier. And during that time, Jack was almost always the host for all of those shows. So like I've seen Jack Baker do more comedy than anybody else I've seen. And he used to always say that nobody's seen more Jack Baker comedy than I have. But that's because I watched him just host every week and just, and I watched him get better at it. But as he was getting better, then I would, occasionally, like if I got a chance to, host an open mic, I would just like, I don't know what to do here, fall back on what I've seen him do, fall back on what I've seen Drefke do. That's pretty much, and you guys were always great about like advice too.
I mean, well, like just to take what you said, when I got started, which would have been about 5 years before you, the first guy giving me a lot of chances at like weekend work and things like that was this guy, Bert Borth. And Bert used to run, he had run Walter Payton's Roundhouse, what became Two Brothers Roundhouse, where I run the show. And like when I would watch him host a room, I always thought it was like a little cheesy and a little hacky and whatever. But no matter what happened, when he was ready to bring up that first comic, everyone in the audience was ready for that comic. Like they were, so like as I eventually started moving on to like being a regular host, I found myself doing many of the exact same things Bert did. Like things that, like, looking back at, like, when I had started performing, I would have rolled my eyes and been like, oh, that seems like a little much. But it's like, no, that all has a purpose. Like, that has a purpose and a plan and a formula. And if you get that to work, it's going to work super well.
This is some great inside stuff. Great stuff.
Behind the technical aspect of it too. I mean, some open mics and they're just in a bar or whatever. It's just like, all right, let's bring up the first, let's bring up our next comedian or whatever. But if you actually are in a club and they have the ability to do lights and actually sound like you can start out, I got to pick what song we're bringing people out to. I brought Jack out to Cult of Personality a number of times. There were times where I would try another song and maybe he'd like it, and there were other times where, like, if he like, I think I tried Enter Sandman once just because I think that's an awesome song. And as soon as I brought the music down, he was like, well, I don't know why we came out to that super depressing song. And he just gave me shit about it publicly. I'm like, well, I guess we're not using that one again. But yeah, it's all about setting that tone successfully, which, I didn't in that case. But speaking of which, by the way, Drefke, I remember very, like, when I first started working there. You told me, or maybe I overheard you tell somebody else, you were like, we always start with Curtis Mayfield's Superfly. That's always the first song as you're bringing people into the room. And I held true to that rule for my entire time there. Every single time I'd have a playlist, I'd always start with Superfly. And so now every time I hear that song, it's a great song, but whenever I hear it, I think back to the Comedy Shrine. I'm like, Drefke, be proud.
Isn't that great? Isn't that great how it has such a memory? I'll tell you the opposite version of that. So again, I'm going back to Bert and the guy who I started running shows with. He was a real big fan of this artist, Buckwheat Zydeco. He really enjoyed Zydeco music. So he would open all of his shows with this Zydeco song. And one day I'm driving on the highway. This was long after, in fact, that Bert had moved away. I hadn't talked to him in a couple of years. And the lead singer of Buckwheat Zydeco had died, and they were like playing one of his songs on NPR or something like that, just talking about the impact he had on the scene. And I found myself having like a full panic attack. And it took me a little bit to realize what was happening. And I realized that, like, oh, that song was triggering me hearing that in the club back when I was not good enough to, like, and so just hearing that song, I'd be like, oh, I'm about to go on stage and have people not like me. And it was so weird, like, feeling that way again. Even now, like, if that song came on right now, I get like tight in the chest, just like,
Sure.
ah. Paul F. Tompkins, the comedian, says that like there was a smell in the club that he started in Philly, where like if he catches that smell now, he finds himself getting afraid because it takes him back to like going up for those first times and knowing that like, look, I'm gonna try my best, but like it's not gonna go great. And it's crazy how your other senses can kick into that.
Yeah.
Wow. I
Especially
never even thought
music is
that.
just, it's fascinating to me, just like how much of a connection that makes in your brain.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm going back to Jack Baker saying, why did I come up to this song? You guys know each other, right? So he's giving you shit, but you guys know each other, your buddies. I'm gonna imagine that as a stand-up comedy guy, you try to avoid fucking with the light guy and the sound guy. Because he doesn't have a mic, but he can still mess the rest of your day up if he wants to, right?
Oh, absolutely. If you
That's
get the sound guy angry with you,
right.
then you're coming up to a garbage song, or you're coming up and the lights aren't working well. No, the first thing you do when you're in a new room is you find the person running lights and sound,
Yes.
and you shake their hand, you introduce yourself, you're
Yep.
always being more friendly. Also, because they're the person who so in comedy, when you have like a minute or 2 minutes left or whatever, you'll see a flashlight, like someone shines a light in the back. And so like they're often also the person running the light and letting you know what your time is. You don't want the person who has that power to not like you, like to
Right.
think that like you like there's something wrong.
True. But when you're the light and sound guy and all the people that you're doing the light and sound for are your peers and some people that are like, have been doing it longer and you want to win over their respect, you also that's dampened down just a little bit. 'Cause they, I there were probably times I would have done, I was like, all right, screw this guy. But like, if Jack Baker makes fun of me publicly on stage, it's kind of hard for me to throw Jack under the bus without it looking right. really bad or right. him getting mad at me, Like, right. I gotta walk that line pretty carefully.
Okay, so Please. The next section in the blog, it's titled A Glass of Chocolate Milk. And it's such a funny story to me. We've already clarified that Matt is not Fred. The guy's name is Fred. I know that it can't be Jack Baker because one of his bits is that he's allergic to milk. So he wouldn't think True. That chocolate milk is a baller move. So I guess my one question is, Mike, if that's not the most baller move you've ever done, what is the most baller move you've ever done? Or are we still waiting for it to happen, or what might it be? And Trufke, if you got yourself a baller move, let's throw it out there.
I'm going to be optimistic and say that it's yet to happen. I think there's always potential to do a more baller move yeah. because as everybody knows, baller is exactly the word you would use to describe Mike freaking Wilden.
Absolutely.
man, he said it with such enthusiasm too. He wasn't joking. He genuinely like Drufke, I don't know. You probably had people on the scene that were just like really friendly and maybe overly enthusiastically supportive because mm-hmm. this guy was just like, I mean, that the things he would say about me or to me bordered on rude, but still in that way where he's like, this is awesome. You're awesome because of this. And I'm like, I don't know. And he got so excited when I ordered that milk. He had that same reaction. Did you just order a chocolate milk? And, like I write, like, okay, here we go. But he was so excited. That's the most baller thing you've ever done. He wanted to spin that. And that's a really cool thing to do. But in that case, you can just say, hey, that's cool. You don't care what people think. I respect that, rather than that's the greatest thing you've ever done in your life.
Yeah, that's a very weird, insult mentis compliment. yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have a baller move. I'm just like, that's a weird thing for anyone to say. And if someone yeah. told it to me, I would be confused. Yeah. And I would probably assume they were making fun of me, if I'm being entirely honest. That's what.
Well, it kind of asks you to brag, right? Like, I think if somebody asked Mike, what's the most baller thing you've ever done? It's probably, I lived and worked in Hawaii for 6 weeks,
Yeah.
Like, just look
Four
at
months,
some of the stuff you're proud of. Oh, I'm sorry. How long was it, Mike? I didn't mean to get that wrong.
That's all right. We can continue.
All right. So we get through the garage show. We get through stumbling along the Oregon Trail and then the glass of chocolate milk. And you write your summary. And your summary is, this is what I learned from all of this. This is why I am the person I am. My last question about the blog for you is, how did you feel while reflecting on that part of your life and writing this blog episode? Was it kind of fond memories? Was it a little bit of hurt? Like, what kind of emotions were you going through while you're writing this? Because I really do enjoy this blog entry. It's a good look inside of Mike Wilden, the baller.
Thank you. Sure. Well, thank you for that. But, I wrote this kind of early on. Like, I wrote the original version of this a couple years ago, and then I went back and, changed it around a little bit. The core, like, those three stories were still the stories, the main story that I told. But I don't know. I kind of messed around with the overall message a lot since then. Just because at the time that you and I were talking, it was, I describe it as a breakup. And that's kind of how that was how I felt about it. It was still a little bitter for me where it was like, I appreciate what this was in my life and everything, but I can't like that this isn't me anymore. And I kind of, I didn't watch as much stand up for a little while. It just, I don't know, it kind of hurt.
Was it bitter because you didn't think you had gotten out of it what you felt like you deserved, or because you hadn't reached some sort of milestone?
All of the above, I think, at the time. Part of it was that I also felt like for a long time I would kind of blame it on other things. And I'll tell you what my thought was then. I don't necessarily have this view of it now. But, there were a couple of times I had bad breaks where it was like, I got the job doing the light and sound in the sound booth. And that took up every Friday night and every Saturday night, which, you know, when are the shows you're trying to get booked on? At least at that point in time, most of them that I knew about were Friday nights and Saturday nights.
Sure.
So I would try and, like, you know, I'd ask, hey, could I like just have a 5 minute spot on stage? And the owner of the club was like, no, we can't have the light guy do that. And he just treated me like that. I'm like, oh, okay. So I did learn a lot there, but after a while, that learning tapered off and plateaued. And then it was just a minimum wage job that took up my weekends. And for a good year or so, I kind of resented going there because it was also ruining my social life. You know, all my friends from work and everything would be going out and having parties and having fun, and they'd be telling stories at work or when I would get to hang out with them outside of work. And they'd bring something up and they'd be, hey, you remember you were there, right? Oh no, you were working. And that just became the normal thing. And it got to the point where they stopped inviting me to stuff because they just knew I wasn't available. And I was like, what am I doing here? And so it just kind of was like, ugh. Well, then I
Well, and
finally
it's
got out of that job. And by then it was just kind of like, well, the only open mic that was close by was did an open mic once a month. And it was a great show, but I just, you know, it's that's not enough to really keep improving. And so I just kept on getting discouraged. I used to say all of that as a way of blaming something else for causing me to fail, but ultimately that was just I couldn't get past the obstacles that were in front of me. And I mean, ultimately it drove me to where I'm at now, which is better for me anyway, which is the whole point of this thing. But yeah, I felt like, to answer your question, Drofke, part of it was I was frustrated because I hadn't gotten to where I wanted to at that point, and I'd seen some people get to, you know, like Fred. Fred was getting booked on shows that I was like, you got booked at the Funny Bone? You got booked on this? Like, how did you get booked there? Your comedy sucks.
doing jokes about Ovaltine.
No, his jokes were all about like getting laid and how good he was at sex, which like I don't know. There was one point he legitimately was trying to tell me, oh yeah, so there's a way that you can like form your act to get laid. I'm like, I don't want to do that. That's not like I could. That's another thing. I couldn't pull off Lewis Black. I couldn't pull that off either. If I went on stage
Right.
and I was the guy that's just like, yeah, you ladies should all be having sex with me right now. Like that, nobody's gonna buy that from Mike Wilden.
Wait a minute. You're trying to say there was a gross sex pest in comedy? I cannot believe it. I cannot believe it.
Yes.
Oh my
Right.
goodness. The devil, you say.
You know, I'd see somebody like that to kind of get back on topic here, have all this success, and I felt hamstrung by like this job, and I just didn't have as many opportunities, which was just part mostly schedule wise. But I also just felt like whether it was schedule wise or not, I was like, man, I could succeed so much more if I had. But you know, as time went on, I ultimately quit to go back to school because I was like, every time I would like kind of have a comeback, and then I'd get frustrated by something else, and then I'd come back and get frustrated. I knew that if I kept doing that while I was in school, it would just cause me more devastation. So I just kind of made the decision before I went to Echo School, like, I'm not going on stage. Because if as soon as I do, I'm going to get that spark and I'm going to start working on this again. And then something else is going to, and what was going to happen was I was going to get too busy with school. And that absolutely would have happened. Absolutely. With how crazy school is, there's no way I would have had time. And it would have just been another defeat for me. And so I think it was still Larson when you and I first met. I mean, I was 3 years into Echo. So I think it had mostly kind of died down. But I guess at that point, I hadn't really thought of my time in comedy as anything other than like I know there are like good things I took from this, and I'm reluctantly like appreciating this. But at the time, I was like, also like, I hadn't thought of it anything else as a failure. So when we, you know, started doing this and I wrote that and I was like, well, I got to spin it in a positive way. Okay, great. But then, you know, it took you and I 3 years to put the story together before we actually started publishing. So when I went back, you know, a couple months ago or whatever, we've been reflecting so much throughout our project here. It was just I just realized it had completely changed. Like I have so much more of an appreciation for it. Part of that too was also when I finally actually started getting out there and seeing people from the stand-up scene. Like when I went to Jack Baker's roast, I was adamant I wasn't even going near it. But when I heard that was happening, I'm like, okay, well, I gotta go to that, like for sure. And then seeing Jack and seeing you, Drofke, and just seeing some of these people that, and then everybody, when they'd seen me, they were all like happy to see me. And I went, oh, okay, like I had a better, more positive of an impact on these people than I, maybe thought that I did, which is kind of a pattern for me in life anyway. But yeah, I think that's when I started to kind of turn my look at it. But yeah, it's just been really nice. It was really when I actually wrote this to finally circle back, short story long, I am fucked this weekend with this writing contest. But I just it's as with anything we've been doing, it's been great to reflect on it, but more than anything we've written about so far, I kind of gained a lot more appreciation for where I've been, and it kind of fit more into the title anyway. It was like, oh, how to succeed at failing your dream. Like, oh, this is actually a huge success for me, just not in the way that I thought it was going to be. And it's better that way. Like, again, I think I said it earlier. If I'd gotten what I wanted back then, as far as how much success I wanted, I don't think, I mean, I wouldn't be where I am today anyway, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'd be, as content with who I am or where I was.
Drofke, a couple times you looked like you had a reaction you wanted to throw back at him, and that was quite
I was
the
thinking.
soliloquy there for a minute. You got anything
No,
to
I was
thanks.
thinking
Sorry
so
about
much
that.
about what Mike was saying and my reactions to what Mike wrote. And I think I like to contextualize it and to personalize it is that, like, I mean, to do well in comedy takes as much skill as it does luck. And that's a lot in both elements. Even to move up to like a rank where you are just like performing at local bar shows and then taking the steps to working in clubs and doing all of that. And that, like, I, in the boy, almost 20 years I've been doing this, I've gotten very lucky in the that I've gotten to perform with heroes and I've gotten to perform in some of the coolest rooms in the country. And I've always been super grateful for that. But it would be like through all of that, like if I stepped away today and I were reflecting back on comedy, very little of the things I would be grateful for would be any of the times I was on stage telling jokes. The entirety of what I would consider myself so lucky and fortunate and blessed to do would be all the amazing friendships that I had made, all of the great laughs I got to have before or after shows, all of the wonderful experiences I got to have driving to venues with people. Just like all of those memories make the comedy itself. And look, I love and I still love performing. I'm still thrilled and also very lucky to be able to get the chance to work hard and to do it. But through it all, the most important things for me were the things that people, and I imagine that people who achieve success very early in their comedy career get to miss out on, which is like the friendships that come from being part of a important community, like of a community. And a community of people who like understand that, like, look, we're never gonna have the textbook definition of making it. But if we have these people, and these are the people who we care about and we love and we spend time around, and we challenge and push to make each other funnier and better as comics, and we challenge and push each other to make them funnier, like to make them better as people, like that's the win right there. That's the success right there. That's why I still keep producing a show, is because right now I produce a show with, seven other comedians, of which I've been doing comedy way longer than most of them, and some cases many of them combined of their experience. And to me, it's not about like what I get from the stage, but about how I can help these people like be good comics and be good people and spend time with my friends. Like that is what is so important to me. That is why I still keep getting on stage, if I'm being honest.
I'm really enjoying hearing, I know I said this earlier, but hearing about the culture and, like you said, the community. This is a great insight.
Oh, and don't get me wrong, there are fucking creeps.
I'm
I, by the way,
sure.
I apologize. I realize I may be the only person cursing, and if you have to bleep this all out, I feel very badly.
Nope, we've been pretty
No,
open about that.
you can say fuck as often as you want. We don't mind.
There are creeps, and there are sex pests, and there are real gross people. And it's sometimes a real horrible place to be around. And there are people who go on stage with an attempt to be super shocking and offensive, and you see how that affects women who do comedy and people of color who do
Sure.
comedy and LGBT comedians and things like that. And it's horrendous that these people would want to use their skills and their gifts to be so harmful and to be so dividing and things like that. Like, there are horrendous elements to comedy, which is why, like, when you find wonderful people like Mike, like Jack, like some of the other people, like, it's such a wonderful joy. Like, you know, much like just finding a wonder, like a like as hard like we're all adult men. It's hard to find friends in what we do. Like, it's hard to find people who have things in common. So when you find these people, you realize like what a blessing it is, and you want to cherish that and hold on to that, and share your life experiences with these people.
That's great. That is just great. Mike, I'm through my
Right on.
outline. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about with how to succeed at failing your dream?
I mean, I think we've covered the blog itself probably pretty well. Unless, Drufke, is there anything else you wanted to say on it?
I mean, I feel like I really put a like that last thing was really what I gathered from it, and how much I enjoy like being able to use what you wrote, which was very eloquent and wonderful, like as a reflection of looking back
Thank you.
at, you know, a guy getting ready to start his third decade in comedy. So like that's, you know, that's that there was a joy to that, and I'm very grateful to be able to be part of this conversation.
Well, it's been great having you. Hey, what's
Of
next for
course,
you?
glad to have
Drufke,
me.
what's up on your career? What's next?
Just doing a couple of shows. I run a great show every Thursday night at Two Brothers Roundhouse in Aurora. It's called Still Not Friday. If you Google us, you find all our social media. It's an 8 o'clock free show every Thursday. We have amazing comedians. We've had great, you know, we've had comedians who have been on television and Saturday Night Live and performed all over. It's always a joy to run. And if people have free time on their Thursday nights, they should come and party with us in Aurora.
I love that. I definitely want to come out and see. I've been to a lot of shows and I love them every time, and I'm sure it would be great. I remember seeing you on stage and loved it. And I have to say, that night Jack was filming his show, I really enjoyed watching Mike interact with a whole bunch of people in the room that I didn't know. Like the community feel that you guys are talking about, as soon as the show was over, Mike's like, "Hey, I got to go talk to some people." And it was kind of fun seeing him in his element.
It was great to see Mike and Nate Hamilton and a bunch of people I hadn't seen in a really long time. That was a really fun night of just and what it is to go back to what you say, it was the better part of the community, which was of all of us getting together and being like, oh, hey, man, like our boy's done well, you know? Like, as I'll get ready to start prepping a second record and maybe record something in a couple of years, that to me, that'll be the most fun is like getting people together and like bringing a community together and just having a fun celebrate, like, celebratory night.
Hey Matt, what's the name of that record and where could somebody find it?
Sure. My record is called This Is Supposed to Be Fun, which is something I would find myself yelling at miserable comedians at open mics, like people who would just get so stressed out. I'm like, this is supposed to be fun. Like, what are you doing? You can find that on any streaming service that you get for free. Just get it for free. It's like you could buy it somewhere and then I'll get a nickel, or you just listen to it for free and I'll get nothing. And so that's fine also. Like, it was
I bought the CD back in the day, so
Oh, that's very sweet
I'm
of
proud to
you.
have that.
Yeah, it came out in 2012, and I was super proud of it, and actually just reheard it recently and still proud of it. And I hadn't listened to it in a whole bunch of years, but put it on.
That's great. That's
Yeah,
great.
it's a great set.
All right. Well, while you're here, Mike and I. Oh,
I also
sorry.
feel like because we've been talking about him, check out Jack's special, Jack Baker's Disease on YouTube. It's a wonderful special. I will say one of the things, and I kind of briefly mentioned it. I was the opener for that, so I was doing 15 minutes before Jack, and he was very lucky he had an opener because in the middle of my set, the film crew knocked a plug out of an outlet, and the stage spotlight stopped. So I was in complete darkness. That Jack has a great picture of it. And like it was watching everyone scramble. And I did not realize how dark the room was because there were still like lights on around the side. I didn't realize how full dark it was till I saw what people in the audience saw. And it was just one of those real silly things that happens in comedy. But it was such a joy to be part of Jack Baker's. It's funny, I'm promoting it more than my stuff. But Jack Baker's Disease is great.
It was a great show.
It is.
It's a great show.
Still not Friday.
You handled the lights out thing like a champ, too.
It's not like somebody's waving a possum around, for God's sake. It's just lights were out for a second. Okay, so at the end of our session here, Mike and I wanted to make an announcement here on our podcast. Having talked about this so many times, and even on that first night when we met and had some beers, we committed that one day we would get up on stage together and go do an open mic. And so... Mike, when do you feel like doing this?
We were talking about the set. Let's do it August 7th. That's a Wednesday. We're going to be at the Comedy Vault in Batavia, Illinois. And come on down. There's going to be a whole lot of comedians going on stage. But that's the same place that Jack taped his special we were just talking about, Jack Baker's Disease.
Yep.
I've only been there that one time, but it seemed like a great room. Drufke, do you have anything to say about it?
Very fun room. The Vault is a room that like does comedy super well and treats people super great. I've been lucky to perform there. I've been even luckier to watch shows there. So like a super great room, had so much fun.
Yep. So Mike's going to return to his former passion and I'm going to try it out for the first time ever and try not to embarrass myself is basically the goal there. So, hey, huge thank you, Drufke, for showing up today.
I do echo that, but I'm going to repeat it in just a second, because I do want to mention when you were asking about what it was like to write this, the most challenging part of writing, like of rewriting this whole thing was giving the message of like, hey, I'm good without having succeeded in comedy, but also knowing like we've been talking about this, like, hey, we're going to get back on stage. Like I'm going to do this again. So does this message still sink in? Like that was kind of difficult for me.
Sure.
I don't know. I've always written stuff. Even when I was away from it, I would still think of, you know, jokes and like, I don't know, someday. I'm excited for it. And it's kind of, you know, it's a hobby. It's another outlet, kind of like you were saying, Drufke. It's not something that I necessarily want to be famous at anymore. So I'm kind of looking forward to going on stage and with that perspective, because I've never gone up there with that perspective before, which I think is honestly a way better perspective of like
less pressure, right?
Like you said, like the title of your album, this is supposed to be fun. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Drufke, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a blast.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been excited for this ever since we started talking about it.
Yep.
Yeah, me too.
Can I just very quickly, if you like anything I've said, you can follow me on all social media. I'm at I Hate Matt Drufke. Drufke is Drufke. on the Twitter and Instagram and TikTok, universally, you can find me all on those things.
That's great. Check them out, people.
And also check out his website, fancyboysclub.com. They really do have a lot of great articles on there. A lot of fun reads. So seriously, go check those out. It's true, but thank you. And thanks for the nice things you've said about my, our blog and our podcast and just this entry in particular, and just for the friendship and the support over the years. It's been great, man.
It's my pleasure. I super appreciate it. The admiration is mutual.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for showing up, Drefty. And, we'll look forward to running into you in the future.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. All right, guys, what a joy to have Matt Drufke with us. Mike, I'm so glad that you picked him as the guest speaker for this. I really hope that people enjoy, getting inside views from the stand-up comedy community. It's just great.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's you're definitely going to get a good insight when you're talking to someone. I was part of it for a few years, but he's been doing it for a couple of decades, basically,
Right.
almost, and or whatever the time is, but he's we used to he used to be known as kind of the Papa Bear of the suburban Chicago the Chicago suburban comedy scene.
Okay.
At least the way I always remember it is people kind of would always rally around him, and he's always been that comedy dad for a lot of people, and so a lot of people in that scene know him, and he's been through it all. A lot of his bits are stories about being a stand-up comedian.
Oh, okay. Like the day the
Not
lights
all of
went
them,
out.
but he had, well, yeah, but he has several great stories in his act. I mean, he tells them on his album, where he's got, just crazy places he's performed or things that didn't go well, and it's great. You get a lot of great insight from him, and he's just such a just a warm, like, lovable human being,
I was just going to say that, hey, just talking to him, you can tell that he's very genuine.
Oh, yeah.
He talks about people being wonderful and being around him makes you better and stuff. You can tell that that's completely genuine from the tone of his voice and we're on the Zoom meeting, so we're looking at him and seems like a great guy. I'm glad I got to meet him. I feel kind of lucky I got to meet that guy today.
I'm glad you did too. I think anybody that meets him is going to be better for it.
Yeah, I'm going to say the only way that you could have picked a better guest for our podcast would be when you did Crash Tyson, if you actually got Mike Tyson to be here as a guest to talk about taking a punch to the face.
Now that would have been a baller move.
That would have been a baller move. Absolutely.
That.
All right, so it's time to introduce what's happening next on our podcast. So we are moving on to episode 15. Which will be mine. And why don't you tell everybody what they're about to hear from episode 15?
Well, we just discussed in length my blog called How to Succeed at Failing Your Dream.
Correct.
So this coming week is going to be Larson's, which is How to Love and Hate Your Job.
Yeah. We were
It's
very
going
clever putting those two next to each other, weren't
to. I enjoy it.
we?
Well, I appreciate the fact that you use that title as to bounce off of it too, regardless of where it was in the order. I think that's fun.
I think this was actually these two went in order when we wrote them. Because if you remember, you would write one and then I would write one kind of as a response. And we had a lot of that back and forth going on. And that's not the order they all ended up in. But I think these two were, because when you wrote How to Succeed at Failing Your Dream, I was like, you know what? It's time to talk about just how upset I was with my job at the time that we met. And this is that story. I love being a teacher,
Yeah.
but I was pretty fed up with some stuff and we're going to hear about it.
Right. So it's kind of your version of what I just told, only rather than the creative side of things, it's the professional side of things.
Yeah.
Because you've got great passion, obviously, for your job as a teacher. So it's going to be fun to see and hear about some of the good parts and some of the things you've taken away from it,
Yeah.
and then some of the struggles.
Yep. And it's part of the story you just have to tell. And some of it's not that great. Right. I mean, that's why I was asking about your last one here. Like, what were your emotions while you were writing it? And, there's some real stuff coming up in here. So we'll save that for the next podcast, though.
Also, the baseball thing is called the California Baseball Bucket List Tour. If you're ever on the fancyboysclub.com website, if anybody wants to read that, that's really kind of the first thing that I've written that I put out on any type of platform online, that wasn't like, social media or whatever. And yeah, I don't know. It was kind of a
And
spark.
that did in part that sparked this whole project that we're on, just as
Yeah.
we were talking, things kind of came together for that. So I have
That
read it. It's
there are
pretty
a
good.
couple of ways. Yeah. Thank you. And one more reminder. You come out and see us August 7th. We're each gonna go on stage. It's gonna be my return after, I wanna say, about 8 years. I haven't been on stage in 8 years, and I'm finally gonna do it at the request of Mr. Larson here. And Larson's going to go on stage as a comedian for the first time ever. So we're going to go to the open mic at the Comedy Vault in Batavia on August 7th.
I think it's 8 p.m. I'm excited about this, and I'm also very nervous about it. I'm not going to lie. But I will point out quite a few. I don't remember which episode, but one of them I was talking about why I became a teacher. And my mother had said, well, you know, being a writer, a lot of people, that's hard to get into. One of them was, well, I think I could be a stand-up comedian. It was one of those series of my mom said, well, you know, it's really hard to get into. I don't know if you could pull that off. and that would have been in the 1990s, I think, or maybe even the 1980s. And so it's been that long. And I'm gonna finally get up there and grab a microphone and see what happens.
You were in the Seinfeld era then. Yeah. Yeah, I'm nervous for you, not because I'm worried about how well you do. I just know what it's like when you get on stage that first time. It's it's scary. But yeah, come out and see us.
Yeah. All right, people. That'll be August 7th. We're going to have as much fun with it as we possibly can, because as our friend Drufke would say, this is supposed to be fun. So,
exactly.
And then catch that blog. How to Love and Hate Your Job will be out next Wednesday. You can get us at 15-years-later.com. That's a numerical 15 with a hyphen dash, years-later.com. And Mike, you can also catch us on social media. Where can people catch us on social media?
We are on Instagram and Threads at 15 Years Later Official. You can also email us at 15yearslaterofficial@gmail.com. You can read all of the blogs on our website. And a reminder, we are partnered with the SPDM Crew Podcasting Network.
So thank you guys for listening once again. We always appreciate the comments, and thanks for reading the blog. This has been a lot of fun for us. We enjoyed talking about how to succeed at failing your dream. Have a good week, everybody.
Take care.